Slip on your ring. Let me off.
But the witch had very good ears. Fool, came her voice.
Have you forgotten that I can hear men's thoughts? Let go the boy. If you attempt treachery, I will take such vengeance upon you as never was heard of in all worlds from the beginning.
And, added Diggory, if you think I'm such a mean pig as to go off and leave Polly and the cabby and the horse in a place like this, you're jolly well mistaken.
You're a very naughty and impertinent little boy, said Uncle Andrew.
Hush,
said the cabby. They all listened. In the darkness, something was happening at last. A voice had begun to sing. It was very far away, and Diggory found it hard to decide from what direction it was coming. Sometimes it seemed to come from all directions at once. Sometimes he almost thought it was coming out of the earth beneath them. Its lower notes were deep enough to be the voice of the earth herself. There were no words. There was hardly even a tune. But it was, beyond comparison, the most beautiful noise he had ever heard. It was so beautiful he could hardly bear it. The horse seemed to like it, too. He gave the sort of whinny a horse would give if, after years of being a cab horse, it found itself back in the old field where it had played as a foal, and saw someone whom it remembered and loved coming across the field to bring it a lump of sugar.
"Good," said the cabby. "Ain't it lovely?"
Then two wonders happened at the same moment. One was that the voice was suddenly joined by other voices, more voices than you could possibly count. They were in harmony with it, but far higher up the scale, cold, tingling, silvery voices. The second wonder was that the blackness overhead all at once was blazing with stars. They didn't come out gently one by one as they do on a summer evening. One moment there had been nothing but darkness. Next moment, 1,000,000 points of light leaped out, single stars, constellations, and planets brighter and bigger than any in our world. There were no clouds. The new stars and the new voices began at exactly the same time. If you had seen and heard it as Diggory did, you would have felt quite certain that it was the stars themselves who were singing, and that it was the first voice, the deep one, which had made them appear and made them sing.
"Glory be," said the cabby. "I'd have been a better man all my life if I'd known there were things like this."
The voice on the earth was now louder and more triumphant, but the voices in the sky, after singing loudly with it for a time, began to get fainter. And now something else was happening. Far away, and down near the horizon, the sky began to turn grey. A light wind, very fresh, began to stir. The sky in that one place grew slowly and steadily paler. You could see shapes of hills standing up dark against it. All the time the voice went on singing. There was soon light enough for them to see one another's faces. The cabby and the two children had open mouths and shining eyes. They were drinking in the sound, and looked as if it reminded them of something. Uncle Andrew's mouth was open too, but not open with joy. He looked more as if his chin had simply dropped away from the rest of his face. His shoulders were stooped and his knees shook. He was not liking the voice. If he could have got away from it by creeping into a rat's hole, he would have done so. But the witch looked as if, in a way, she understood the music better than any of them. Her mouth was shut, her lips were pressed together, and her fists were clenched. Ever since the song began, she had felt that this whole world was filled with a magic different from hers, and stronger. She hated it. She would have smashed that whole world, or all worlds, to pieces, if it would only stop the singing. The horse stood with his ears well forward and twitching. Every now and then he snorted and stamped the ground. He no longer looked like a tired old cab horse. You could now well believe that his father had been in battles. The eastern sky changed from white to pink, and from pink to gold. The voice rose and rose till all the air was shaking with it, and just as it swelled to the mightiest and most glorious sound it had yet produced, the sun arose. Diggory had never seen such a sun. The sun above the ruins of Charn had looked older than ours. This looked younger. You could imagine that it laughed for joy as it came up. and as its beams shot across the land, the travellers could see for the first time what sort of place they were in. It was a valley through which a broad, swift river wound its way, flowing eastward toward the sun. Southward there were mountains, northward there were lower hills, but it was a valley of mere earth, rock, and water. There was not a tree, not a bush, not a blade of grass to be seen. The earth was of many colours. They were fresh, hot, and vivid. They made you feel excited, until you saw the singer himself, and then you forgot everything else. It was a lion. Huge, shaggy, and bright, it stood facing the risen sun. Its mouth was wide open in song, and it was about 300 yards away.
"This is a terrible world," said the witch. "We must fly at once. Prepare the magic."
"I quite agree with you, madam," said Uncle Andrew. "A most disagreeable place, completely uncivilized. If only I were a younger man and had a gun."
"Gun?" said the cabby. "You don't think you could shoot him, do you?"
"And who would?" said Polly.
"Prepare the magic, old fool," said Jadis.
"Certainly, madam," said Uncle Andrew cunningly. "I must have both the children touching me. Put on your homeward ring at once, Diggory." He wanted to get away without the witch.
"Oh, it rings, is it?" cried Jadis, leaping off the horse. She would have had her hands in Diggory's pocket before you could say knife, but Diggory grabbed Polly and shouted out, "Take care! If either of you come half an inch nearer, we two will vanish, and you'll be left here for good. Yes, I have a ring in my pocket that will take Polly and me home. And look, my hand is just ready. So keep your distance."
"I'm sorry about you," he looked at the cabby, "and about the horse, but I can't help that. As for you two," he looked at Uncle Andrew and the Queen, "you're both magicians, so you ought to enjoy living together."
"Hold your noise, everyone," said the cabby. "I want to listen to the music."
For the song had now changed. Chapter 9. The Founding of Narnia. The lion was pacing to and fro about that empty land and singing his new song. It was softer and more lilting than the song by which he had called up the stars and the sun, a gentle, rippling music. And as he walked and sang, the valley grew green with grass. It spread out from the lion like a pool. It ran up the sides of the little hills like a wave. In a few minutes it was creeping up the lower slopes of the distant mountains, making that young world every moment softer. The light wind could now be heard ruffling the grass. Soon there were other things besides grass. The higher slopes grew dark with heather. Patches of rougher and more bristling green appeared in the valley. Diggory did not know what they were until one began coming up quite close to him. It was a little spiky thing that grew out dozens of arms, and covered these arms with green, and grew larger at the rate of about an inch every 2 seconds. There were dozens of these things all around him now. When they were nearly as tall as himself, he saw what they were.
"Trees!" he exclaimed.
The nuisance of it, as Polly said afterward, was that you weren't left in peace to watch it all. Just as Diggory said, "trees," he had to jump because Uncle Andrew had sidled up to him again and was just going to pick his pocket. It wouldn't have done Uncle Andrew much good if he had succeeded, for he was aiming at the right-hand pocket because he still thought the green rings were homeward rings. But, of course, Diggory didn't want to lose either.
"Stop!" cried the witch. "Stand back! No, further back! If anyone goes within 10 paces of either of the children, I will knock out his brains."
She was poising in her hand the iron bar that she had torn off the lamppost, ready to throw it. Somehow no one doubted that she would be a very good shot.
"So," she said, "you would steal back to your own world with the boy and leave me here."
Uncle Andrew's temper at last got the better of his fears.
"Yes, ma'am, I would," he said. "Most undoubtedly I would. I should be perfectly in my rights. I have been most shamefully, most abominably treated. I have done my best to show you such civilities as were in my power, and what has been my reward? You have robbed, I must repeat that word, robbed a highly respectable jeweller. You have insisted on my entertaining you to an exceedingly expensive, not to say ostentatious, lunch, though I was obliged to pawn my watch and chain in order to do so, and let me tell you, ma'am, that none of our family have been in the habit of frequenting pawn shops, except my cousin Edward, and he was in the yeomanry. During that indigestible meal, I'm feeling the worse for it at this very moment, your behaviour and conversation attracted the unfavourable attention of everyone present. I feel I have been publicly disgraced. I shall never be able to show my face in the Trocadero again. You have assaulted the police. You have stolen—"
"Oh, stow it, governor, do stow it," said the cabby. "Watching and listening to the thing at present, not talking."
There was certainly plenty to watch and to listen to. The tree, which Diggory had noticed first, was now a full-grown beech, whose branches swayed gently above his head. They stood on cool green grass, sprinkled with daisies and buttercups. A little way off along the river bank, willows were growing. On the other side, tangles of flowering currant, lilac, wild rose, and rhododendron closed them in. The horse was tearing up delicious mouthfuls of new grass. All this time the lion's song and his stately prowl to and fro, backward and forward, was going on. What was rather alarming was that at each turn he came a little nearer. Polly was finding the song more and more interesting, because she thought she was beginning to see the connection between the music and the things that were happening. When a line of dark firs sprang up on a ridge about 100 yards away, she felt that they were connected with a series of deep, prolonged notes which the lion had sung a second before. And when he burst into a rapid series of lighter notes, she was not surprised to see primroses suddenly appearing in every direction. Thus, with an unspeakable thrill, she felt quite certain that all the things were coming, as she said, out of the lion's head. When you listened to his song, you heard the things he was making up. When you looked round you, you saw them. This was so exciting that she had no time to be afraid. But Diggory and the cabby could not help feeling a bit nervous as each turn of the lion's walk brought him nearer. As for Uncle Andrew, his teeth were chattering, but his knees were shaking so that he could not run away. Suddenly, the witch stepped boldly out toward the lion. He was coming on, always singing, with a slow, heavy pace. He was only 12 yards away. She raised her arm and flung the iron bar straight at his head. Nobody, least of all Jadis, could have missed at that range. The bar struck the lion fair between the eyes. It glanced off and fell with a thud in the grass. The lion came on. His walk was neither slower nor faster than before. You could not tell whether he even knew he had been hit. Though his soft pads made no noise, you could feel the earth shake beneath their weight. The witch shrieked and ran. In a few moments she was out of sight among the trees. Uncle Andrew turned to do likewise, tripped over a root and fell flat on his face in a little brook that ran down to join the river. The children could not move. They were not even quite sure that they wanted to. The lion paid no attention to them. His huge red mouth was open, but open in song, not in a snarl. He passed by them so close that they could have touched his mane. They were terribly afraid he would turn and look at them, yet in some queer way they wished he would. But for all the notice he took of them, they might just as well have been invisible and unsmellable. When he had passed them and gone a few paces further, he turned, passed them again, and continued his march eastward. Uncle Andrew, coughing and spluttering, picked himself up. "Now, Diggory," he said, "we've got rid of that woman, and the brute of a lion is gone. Give me your hand and put on your ring at once." "Keep off," said Diggory, backing away from him. "Keep clear of him, Polly. Come over here beside me. Now I warn you, Uncle Andrew, don't come one step nearer. We'll just vanish." "Do what you're told this minute, sir," said Uncle Andrew. "You're an extremely disobedient, ill-behaved little boy." "No fear," said Diggory. "We want to stay and see what happens. I thought you wanted to know about other worlds. Don't you like it now you're here?"
"Like it!" exclaimed Uncle Andrew. "Just look at the state I'm in. And it was my best coat and waistcoat, too."
He certainly was a dreadful sight by now, for, of course, the more dressed up you were to begin with, the worse you look after you've crawled out of a smashed hansom cab and fallen into a muddy brook.
I'm not saying, he added, that this is not a most interesting place. If I were a younger man now, perhaps I could get some lively young fellow to come here first. One of those big game hunters. Something might be made of this country. The climate is delightful. I never felt such air. I believe it would have done me good if circumstances had been more favourable. If only we'd had a gun.
Guns be blowed, said the cabby. I think I'll go and see if I can give Strawberry a rub down. That horse has more sense than some humans, as I could mention.
He walked back to Strawberry and began making the hissing noises that grooms make.
Do you still think that lion could be killed by a gun? Asked Diggory.
He didn't mind the iron bar much.
With all her faults, said Uncle Andrew, that's a plucky gel, my boy. It was a spirited thing to do.
He rubbed his hands and cracked his knuckles, as if he were once more forgetting how the witch frightened him whenever she was really there.
It was a wicked thing to do, said Polly. What harm had he done her?
Hullo, what's that? Said Diggory. He had darted forward to examine something only a few yards away.
I say, Polly, he called back, do come and look.
Uncle Andrew came with her. Not because he wanted to see, but because he wanted to keep close to the children. There might be a chance of stealing their rings. But when he saw what Diggory was looking at, even he began to take an interest.
It was a perfect little model of a lamppost, about 3 feet high, but lengthening and thickening in proportion as they watched it. In fact, growing just as the trees had grown.
It's alive, too. I mean, it's lit, said Diggory.
And so it was, though, of course, the brightness of the sun made the little flame in the lantern hard to see unless your shadow fell on it.
Remarkable, most remarkable, muttered Uncle Andrew. Even I never dreamed of magic like this. We're in a world where everything, even a lamppost, comes to life and grows. Now, I wonder what sort of seed a lamppost grows from.
Don't you see, said Diggory, this is where the bar fell, the bar she tore off the lamppost at home. It sank into the ground, and now it's coming up as a young lamppost.
But not so very young now. It was as tall as Diggory while he said this.
That's it. Stupendous, stupendous, said Uncle Andrew, rubbing his hands harder than ever. They laughed at my magic. That fool of a sister of mine thinks I'm a lunatic. I wonder what they'll say now. I have discovered a world where everything is bursting with life and growth. Columbus now. They talk about Columbus. But what was America to this? The commercial possibilities of this country are unbounded. Bring a few old bits of scrap iron here, bury 'em, and up they come as brand new railway engines, battleships, anything you please. They'll cost nothing, and I can sell 'em at full prices in England. I shall be a millionaire. And then the climate, I feel 20 years younger already. I can run it as a health resort. Good sanatorium here might be worth 20,000 a year. Of course, I shall have to let a few people into the secret. The first thing is to get that brute shot.
You're just like the witch, said Polly. All you think of is killing things.
And then as regards oneself, Uncle Andrew continued in a happy dream, there's no knowing how long I might live if I settled here. And that's a big consideration when a fellow's turned 60. I shouldn't be surprised if I never grew a day older in this country.
Stupendous! The land of youth!
Oh, cried Diggory. The land of youth! Do you think it really is?
For of course he remembered what Aunt Letty had said to the lady who brought the grapes, and that sweet hope rushed back upon him. Uncle Andrew, he said, do you think there's anything here that would cure Mother?
What are you talking about? Said Uncle Andrew. This isn't a chemist's shop.
But, as I was saying,
you don't care tuppence about her, said Diggory savagely.
I thought you might. After all, she's your sister as well as my mother.
Well, no matter. I'm jolly well going to ask the lion himself if he can help me.
And he turned and walked briskly away. Polly waited for a moment and then went after him.
Here, stop, come back! The boy's gone mad, said Uncle Andrew.
He followed the children at a cautious distance behind, for he didn't want to get too far away from the green rings or too near the lion. In a few minutes, Diggory came to the edge of the wood, and there he stopped. The lion was singing still, but now the song had once more changed. It was more like what we should call a tune, but it was also far wilder. It made you want to run and jump and climb.
It made you want to shout. It made you want to rush at other people and either hug them or fight them. It made Diggory hot and red in the face. It had some effect even on Uncle Andrew, for Diggory could hear him saying, "A spirited girl, sir. It's a pity about her temper, but a damn fine woman all the same. A damn fine woman." But what the song did to the two humans was nothing compared with what it was doing to the country. Can you imagine a stretch of grassy land bubbling like water in a pot? For that is really the best description of what was happening. In all directions it was swelling into humps. They were of very different sizes, some no bigger than molehills, some as big as wheelbarrows, two the size of cottages. And the humps moved and swelled till they burst, and the crumbled earth poured out of them, and from each hump there came out an animal. The moles came out just as you might see a mole come out in England. The dogs came out, barking the moment their heads were free, and struggling as you've seen them do when they're getting through a narrow hole in a hedge. The stags were the queerest to watch, for of course the antlers came up a long time before the rest of them, so at first Diggory thought they were trees. The frogs, who all came up near the river, went straight into it with a plop-plop and a loud croaking. The panthers, leopards and things of that sort, sat down at once to wash the loose earth off their hind quarters, and then stood up against the trees to sharpen their front claws. Showers of birds came out of the trees. Butterflies fluttered. Bees got to work on the flowers as if they hadn't a second to lose. But the greatest moment of all was when the biggest hump broke like a small earthquake, and out came the sloping back, the large wise head, and the four baggy trousered legs of an elephant. And now you could hardly hear the song of the lion. There was so much cawing, cooing, crowing, braying, neighing, baying, barking, lowing, bleating, and trumpeting. But though Diggory could no longer hear the lion, he could see him. He was so big and so bright that Diggory could not take his eyes off him. The other animals did not appear to be afraid. Indeed, at that very moment, Diggory heard the sound of hoofs from behind. A second later, the old cab horse trotted past him and joined the other beasts. The air had apparently suited him as well as it had suited Uncle Andrew. He no longer looked like the poor old slave he had been in London. He was picking up his feet and holding his head erect. And now, for the first time, the lion was quite silent. He was going to and fro among the animals, and every now and then he would go up to two of them, always two at a time, and touch their noses with his. He would touch two beavers among all the beavers, two leopards among all the leopards, one stag and one deer among all the deer, and leave the rest. Some sorts of animal he passed over altogether, but the pairs which he had touched instantly left their own kinds and followed him. At last he stood still, and all the creatures whom he had touched came and stood in a wide circle around him. The others whom he had not touched began to wander away. Their noises faded gradually into the distance. The chosen beasts who remained were now utterly silent, all with their eyes fixed intently upon the lion. The cat-like ones gave an occasional twitch of the tail, but otherwise all were still. For the first time that day, there was complete silence, except for the noise of running water. Diggory's heart beat wildly. He knew something very solemn was going to be done. He had not forgotten about his mother, but he knew jolly well that even for her he couldn't interrupt a thing like this. The lion, whose eyes never blinked, stared at the animals as hard as if he was going to burn them up with his mere stare, and gradually a change came over them. The smaller ones, the rabbits, moles, and such like, grew a good deal larger. The very big ones, you noticed it most with the elephants, grew a little smaller. Many animals sat up on their hind legs. Most put their heads on one side as if they were trying very hard to understand. The lion opened his mouth, but no sound came from it. He was breathing out a long, warm breath. It seemed to sway all the beasts as the wind sways a line of trees. Far overhead, from beyond the veil of blue sky which hid them, the stars sang again. A pure, cold, difficult music. Then there came a swift flash like fire, but it burned nobody, either from the sky or from the lion himself, and every drop of blood tingled in the children's bodies, and the deepest, wildest voice they had ever heard was saying, "Narnia, Narnia, Narnia, awake!"
Love, think, speak, be walking trees, be talking beasts, be divine waters.
Chapter 10. The First Joke and Other Matters. It was, of course, the lion's voice. The children had long felt sure that he could speak, yet it was a lovely and terrible shock when he did. Out of the trees wild people stepped forth, gods and goddesses of the wood. With them came fauns and satyrs and dwarfs. Out of the river rose the river god with his naiad daughters, and all these and all the beasts and birds in their different voices, low or high or thick or clear, replied,
"Hail Aslan! We hear and obey. We are awake, we love, we think, we speak, we know."
"But please, we don't know very much yet," said a nosy and snorty kind of voice,
and that really did make the children jump, for it was the cab horse who had spoken.
"Good old Strawberry," said Polly. "I'm glad he was one of the ones picked out to be a talking beast."
And the cabby, who was now standing beside the children, said,
"Strike me pink. I always did say as that horse had a lot of sense, though."
"Creatures, I give you yourselves," said the strong, happy voice of Aslan. "I give to you forever this land of Narnia. I give you the woods, the fruits, the rivers. I give you the stars, and I give you myself. The dumb beasts whom I have not chosen are yours also. Treat them gently and cherish them. But do not go back to their ways, lest you cease to be talking beasts. For out of them you were taken, and into them you can return. Do not so."
"No, Aslan, we won't, we won't," said everyone.
But one perky jackdaw added in a loud voice,
"No fear!"
And everyone else had finished just before he said it, so that his words came out quite clear in a dead silence. And perhaps you have found out how awful that can be, say at a party. The jackdaw became so embarrassed that he hid his head under his wing as if he were going to sleep, and all the other animals began making various queer noises, which are their way of laughing, and which, of course, no one has ever heard in our world. They tried at first to repress it, but Aslan said,
"Laugh and fear not, creatures. Now that you are no longer dumb and witless, you need not always be grave. For jokes as well as justice come in with speech."
So they all let themselves go, and there was such merriment that the jackdaw himself plucked up courage again and perched on the cab horse's head between his ears, clapping his wings, and said,
"Aslan, Aslan, have I made the first joke? Will everybody always be told how I made the first joke?"
"No, little friend," said the lion, "you have not made the first joke. You have only been the first joke." Then everyone laughed more than ever, but the jackdaw didn't mind, and laughed just as loud, till the horse shook his head and the jackdaw lost his balance and fell off,
but remembered his wings. They were still new to him, before he reached the ground.
"And now," said Aslan, "Narnia is established. We must next take thought for keeping it safe. I will call some of you to my council. Come hither to me, you the chief dwarf, and you the river god, and you oak, and the he-owl, and both the ravens, and the bull elephant. We must talk together, for though the world is not 5 hours old, an evil has already entered it."
The creatures he had named came forward, and he turned away eastward with them. The others all began talking, saying things like,
"What did he say had entered the world? A nevil? What's a nevil? No, he didn't say a nevil, he said a weevil. Well, what's that?"
"Look here," said Diggory to Polly, "I've got to go after him. Aslan, I mean, the lion. I must speak to him."
"Do you think we can?" said Polly. "I wouldn't dare."
"I've got to," said Diggory. "It's about Mother. If anyone could give me something that would do her good, it would be him."
"I'll come along with you," said the cabby. "I like the looks of him. I don't reckon these other beasts will go for us. And I want a word with old Strawberry."
So all three of them stepped out boldly, or as boldly as they could, toward the assembly of animals. The creatures were so busy talking to one another and making friends that they didn't notice the three humans until they were very close.
Nor did they hear Uncle Andrew, who was standing trembling in his buttoned boots a good way off and shouting, but by no means at the top of his voice,
"Diggory, come back! Come back at once when you're told! I forbid you to go a step further!"
When at last they were right in among the animals all stopped talking and stared at them.
"Well,"
said the he-beaver at last,
"what in the name of Aslan are these?"
"Please," began Diggory in rather a breathless voice, when a rabbit said,
"They're a kind of large letters, that's my belief."
"No, we're not, honestly, we're not," said Polly hastily. "We're not at all nice to eat."
"There," said the mole, "they can talk. Who ever heard of a talking lettuce?"
"Perhaps they're the second joke,"
suggested the jackdaw. A panther, which had been washing its face, stopped for a moment to say,
"Well, if they are, they're nothing like so good as the first one. At least I don't see anything very funny about them."
It yawned and went on with its wash.
"Oh, please," said Diggory, "I'm in such a hurry. I want to see the lion."
All this time the cabbie had been trying to catch Strawberry's eye. Now he did.
"Now, Strawberry, old boy," he said, "you know me. You ain't going to stand there and say as you don't know me."
"What's the thing talking about, horse?" said several voices.
"Well," said Strawberry very slowly, "I don't exactly know. I think most of us don't know much about anything yet. But I've a sort of idea I've seen a thing like this before. I've a feeling I lived somewhere else, or was something else, before Aslan woke us all up a few minutes ago. It's all very muddled, like a dream. But there were things like these three in the dream."
"What?" said the cabbie. "Not know me? Me what used to bring you a hot mash of an evening when you was out of sorts? Me what rubbed you down proper? Me what never forgot to put your cloth on you if you were standing in a cold? I wouldn't have thought it of you, Strawberry."
"It does begin to come back," said the horse thoughtfully. "Yes, let me think now. Let me think. Yes, you used to tie a horrid black thing behind me, and then hit me to make me run. And however far I ran, this black thing would always be coming rattle-rattle behind me."
"We had our living to earn, see," said the cabbie. "Yours the same as mine. If there hadn't been no work and no whip, there'd have been no stable, no hay, no mash and no oats. For you did get a taste of oats when I could afford them, which no one can deny."
"Oats," said the horse, pricking up his ears. "Yes, I remember something about that. Yes, I remember more and more. You were always sitting up somewhere behind, and I was always running in front, pulling you and the black thing. I know I did all the work."
"Summer, I grant you," said the cabbie. "Hot work for you and a cool seat for me. But what about winter, old boy, when you was keeping yourself warm and I was sitting up there with my feet like ice and my nose fair pinched off me with the wind and my hands that numb I couldn't hardly hold the reins?"
"It was a hard, cruel country," said Strawberry. "There was no grass, all hard stones."
"Too true, mate, too true," said the cabbie. "A hard world it was. I always did say those paving stones weren't fair on any horse. This Lunnon, that is. I don't like it no more than what you did. You were a country horse, and I was a country man. Used to sing in the choir, I did, down at home. But there wasn't a living for me there."
"Oh, please, please," said Diggory, "could we get on? The lion's getting further and further away, and I do want to speak to him so dreadfully badly."
"Look here, Strawberry," said the cabbie. "This young gentleman has something on his mind that he wants to talk to the lion about, him you call Aslan. Suppose you was to let him ride on your back, which he'd take it very kindly, and trot him over to where the lion is, and me and a little girl will be following along."
"Ride," said Strawberry. "Oh, I remember now. That means sitting on my back. I remember there used to be a little one of you two-leggers used to do that long ago. He used to have little hard square lumps of some white stuff that he gave me. They tasted, oh, wonderful, sweeter than grass."
"Ah, that'd be sugar," said the cabbie.
"Please, Strawberry," begged Diggory, do let me get up and take me to Aslan."
"Well, I don't mind," said the horse. "Not for once in a way. Up you get."
"Good old Strawberry," said the cabbie.
"Here, young'un, I'll give you a lift."
Diggory was soon on Strawberry's back, and quite comfortable, for he had ridden bareback before on his own pony. "Now do gee up, Strawberry," he said.
"You don't happen to have a bit of that white stuff about you, I suppose?" said the horse.
"No, I'm afraid I haven't," said Diggory.
"Well, it can't be helped," said Strawberry, and off they went.
At that moment a large bulldog, who had been sniffing and staring very hard, said,
"Look, isn't there another one of those queer creatures over there, beside the river, under the trees?"
Then all the animals looked and saw Uncle Andrew, standing very still among the rhododendrons, and hoping he wouldn't be noticed. "Come on," said several voices, "let's go and find out." So while Strawberry was briskly trotting away with Diggory in one direction, and Polly and the cabbie were following on foot, most of the creatures rushed towards Uncle Andrew with roars, barks, grunts, and various noises of cheerful interest. We must now go back a bit and explain what the whole scene had looked like from Uncle Andrew's point of view. It had not made at all the same impression on him as on the cabbie and the children, for what you see and hear depends a good deal on where you are standing. It also depends on what sort of person you are. Ever since the animals had first appeared, Uncle Andrew had been shrinking further and further back into the thicket. He watched them very hard, of course, but he wasn't really interested in seeing what they were doing, only in seeing whether they were going to make a rush at him. Like the witch, he was dreadfully practical. He simply didn't notice that Aslan was choosing one pair out of every kind of beasts. All he saw, or thought he saw, was a lot of dangerous wild animals walking vaguely about, and he kept on wondering why the other animals didn't run away from the big lion. When the great moment came and the beasts spoke, he missed the whole point, for a rather interesting reason. When the lion had first begun singing, long ago when it was still quite dark, he had realized that the noise was a song, and he had disliked the song very much. It made him think and feel things he did not want to think and feel. Then when the sun rose and he saw that the singer was a lion, only a lion, as he said to himself, he tried his hardest to make himself believe that it wasn't singing, and never had been singing, only roaring, as any lion might in a zoo in our own world. "Of course it can't really have been singing," he thought. "I must have imagined it. I've been letting my nerves get out of order. Who ever heard of a lion singing?" And the longer and more beautifully the lion sang, the harder Uncle Andrew tried to make himself believe that he could hear nothing but roaring. Now, the trouble about trying to make yourself stupider than you really are is that you very often succeed. Uncle Andrew did. He soon did hear nothing but roaring in Aslan's song. Soon he couldn't have heard anything else even if he had wanted to. And when at last the lion spoke and said, "Narnia, awake," he didn't hear any words. He heard only a snarl. And when the beast spoke in answer, he heard only barkings, growlings, bayings, and howlings. And when they laughed, well, you can imagine, that was worse for Uncle Andrew than anything that had happened yet. Such a horrid, bloodthirsty din of hungry and angry brutes he had never heard in his life. Then, to his utter rage and horror, he saw the other three humans actually walking out into the open to meet the animals. "The fools," he said to himself. "Now those brutes will eat the rings along with the children, and I'll never be able to get home again. What a selfish little boy that Diggory is, and the others are just as bad. If they want to throw away their own lives, that's their business. But what about me? They don't seem to think of that. No one thinks of me." Finally, when a whole crowd of animals came rushing toward him, he turned and ran for his life. And now anyone could see that the air of that young world was really doing the old gentleman good. In London he had been far too old to run. Now he ran at a speed which would have made him certain to win the 100 yards race at any prep school in England. His coat-tails flying out behind him were a fine sight. But of course it was no use. Many of the animals behind him were swift ones. It was the first run they had ever taken in their lives, and they were all longing to use their new muscles.
"After him! After him!" they shouted. "Perhaps he's that Neville! Tally-ho, Tantivy! Cut him off! Round him up! Keep it up! Hurrah!"
In a very few minutes some of them got ahead of him. They lined up in a row and barred his way. Others hemmed him in from behind. Wherever he looked, he saw terrors. Antlers of great elks and the huge face of an elephant towered over him. Heavy, serious-minded bears and boars grunted behind him. Cool-looking leopards and panthers with sarcastic faces, as he thought, stared at him and waved their tails.
What struck him most of all was the number of open mouths. The animals had really opened their mouths to pant. He thought they had opened their mouths to eat him. Uncle Andrew stood trembling and swaying this way and that. He had never liked animals at the best of times, being usually rather afraid of them. And, of course, years of doing cruel experiments on animals had made him hate and fear them far more.
"Now, sir," said the bulldog in his businesslike way, "are you animal, vegetable, or mineral?"
That was what he really said, but all Uncle Andrew heard was,
"Chapter
11. Diggory and his uncle are both in trouble. You may think the animals were very stupid not to see at once that Uncle Andrew was the same kind of creature as the two children and the cabby, but you must remember that the animals knew nothing about clothes. They thought that Polly's frock and Diggory's Norfolk suit and the cabby's bowler hat were as much parts of them as their own fur and feathers. They wouldn't have known even that those three were all of the same kind if they hadn't spoken to them, and if Strawberry had not seemed to think so. And Uncle Andrew was a great deal taller than the children, and a good deal thinner than the cabby. He was all in black, except for his white waistcoat, not very white by now, and the great grey mop of his hair, now very wild indeed. Didn't look to them like anything they had seen in the three other humans, so it was only natural that they should be puzzled. Worst of all, he didn't seem to be able to talk. He had tried to. When the bulldog spoke to him, or as he thought, first snarled and then growled at him, he held out his shaking hand and gasped, "Good doggy, then. Poor old fellow." But the beasts could not understand him any more than he could understand them. They didn't hear any words, only a vague sizzling noise. Perhaps it was just as well they didn't, for no dog that I ever knew, least of all a talking dog of Narnia, likes being called a good doggy, then, any more than you'd like being called my little man. Then Uncle Andrew dropped down in a dead faint.
"There," said a warthog. "It's only a tree. I always thought so."
Remember, they had never yet seen a faint or even a fall. The bulldog, who had been sniffing Uncle Andrew all over, raised its head and said,
"It's an animal, certainly an animal, and probably the same kind as those other ones."
"I don't see that," said one of the bears. "An animal wouldn't just roll over like that. We're animals, and we don't roll over. We stand up. Like this."
He rose to his hind legs, took a step backward, tripped over a low branch, and fell flat on his back.
"The third joke! The third joke! The third joke!"
said the jackdaw in great excitement.
"I still think it's a sort of tree," said the warthog.
"If it's a tree," said the other bear, "there might be a bee's nest in it."
"I'm sure it's not a tree," said the badger. "I had a sort of idea it was trying to speak before it toppled over."
"That was only the wind in its branches," said the warthog.
"You surely don't mean,"
said the jackdaw to the badger,
"that you think it's a talking animal. It didn't say any words."
"And yet you know,"
said the elephant, the she-elephant, of course. Her husband, as you remember, had been called away by Aslan.
"And yet you know it might be an animal of some kind. Mightn't the whitish lump at this end be a sort of face? And couldn't those holes be eyes and a mouth? No nose, of course, but then, one mustn't be narrow-minded. Very few of us have what could exactly be called a nose."
She squinted down the length of her own trunk with pardonable pride.
"I object to that remark very strongly," said the bulldog.
"The elephant is quite right," said the tapir.
"I tell you what," said the donkey brightly, "perhaps it's an animal that can't talk, but thinks it can."
"Can it be made to stand up?" said the elephant thoughtfully.
She took the limp form of Uncle Andrew gently in her trunk and set him up on end, upside down, unfortunately, so that 2 half-sovereigns, 3 half-crowns and 6 pence fell out of his pocket. But it was no use. Uncle Andrew merely collapsed again.
"There,"
said several voices. "It isn't an animal at all. It's not alive."
"I tell you, it is an animal," said the bulldog. "Smell it for yourself."
"Smelling isn't everything," said the elephant.
"Why,"
said the bulldog,
"if a fellow can't trust his nose, what is he to trust?"
"Well, his brains, perhaps," she replied mildly.
"I object to that remark very strongly," said the bulldog.
"Well, we must do something about it," said the elephant.
because it may be the Nevil, and it must be shown to Aslan. What do most of us think? Is it an animal, or something of the tree kind?
Tree, tree, said a dozen voices.
Very well, said the elephant. Then if it's a tree, it wants to be planted. We must dig a hole. The two moles settled that part of the business pretty quickly. There was some dispute as to which way up Uncle Andrew ought to be put into the hole, and he had a very narrow escape from being put in head foremost. Several animals said his legs must be his branches, and therefore the grey, fluffy thing, they meant his head, must be his root. But then others said that the forked end of him was the muddier, and that it spread out more, as roots ought to do. So finally he was planted right way up. When they had patted down the earth, it came up above his knees.
"It looks dreadfully withered," said the donkey.
"Of course it wants some watering," said the elephant. "I think, I might say, meaning no offence to anyone present, that perhaps for that sort of work, my kind of nose—"
"I object to that remark very strongly," said the bulldog.
But the elephant walked quietly to the river, filled her trunk with water, and came back to attend to Uncle Andrew. The sagacious animal went on doing this till gallons of water had been squirted over him, and water was running out of the skirts of his frock coat, as if he had been for a bath with all his clothes on. In the end, it revived him. He awoke from his faint. What awakening it was! But we must leave him to think over his wicked deeds, if he was likely to do anything so sensible, and turn to more important things. Strawberry trotted on with Diggory on his back till the noise of the other animals died away. And now the little group of Aslan and his chosen counsellors was quite close. Diggory knew that he couldn't possibly break in on so solemn a meeting, but there was no need to do so. At a word from Aslan, the he-elephant, the ravens, and all the rest of them drew aside. Diggory slipped off the horse and found himself face to face with Aslan. And Aslan was bigger and more beautiful and more brightly golden and more terrible than he had thought. He dared not look into the great eyes.
"Please, Mr. Lion, Aslan, sir," said Diggory, "could you, may I, please, will you give me some magic fruit of this country to make Mother well?"
He had been desperately hoping that the lion would say yes. He had been horribly afraid he might say no, but he was taken aback when he did neither.
"This is the boy," said Aslan,
looking not at Diggory, but at his counsellors.
"This is the boy who did it." "Oh dear," thought Diggory, "what have I done now?" "Son of Adam," said the lion, "there is an evil witch abroad in my new land of Narnia. Tell these good beasts how she came here."
A dozen different things that he might say flashed through Diggory's mind, but he had the sense to say nothing except the exact truth.
"I brought her, Aslan," he answered in a low voice. "For what purpose?"
"I wanted to get her out of my own world, back into her own. I thought I was taking her back to her own place."
"How came she to be in your world, son of Adam?"
By magic."
The lion said nothing, and Diggory knew that he had not told enough.
"It was my uncle, Aslan," he said. "He sent us out of our own world by magic rings. At least, I had to go because he sent Polly first, and then we met the witch in a place called Charn, and she just held on to us when—"
"You met the witch," said Aslan in a low voice which had the threat of a growl in it.
"She woke up," said Diggory wretchedly, "and then turning very white— I mean, I woke her because I wanted to know what would happen if I struck a bell. Polly didn't want to. It wasn't her fault. I fought her. I know I shouldn't have. I think I was a bit enchanted by the writing under the bell."
"Do you?" asked Aslan, still speaking very low and deep. "No," said Diggory. "I see now I wasn't. I was only pretending."
There was a long pause, and Diggory was thinking all the time, "I've spoilt everything. There's no chance of getting anything for Mother now." When the lion spoke again, it was not to Diggory.
"You see, friends," he said, "that before the new clean world I gave you is 7 hours old, a force of evil has already entered it, waked and brought hither by this son of Adam.
the beasts, even Strawberry, all turned their eyes on Diggory, till he felt that he wished the ground would swallow him up.
"But do not be cast down," said Aslan, still speaking to the beasts. "Evil will come of that evil, but it is still a long way off, and I will see to it that the worst falls upon myself. In the meantime, let us take such order that for many hundred years yet this shall be a merry land in a merry world. And as Adam's race has done the harm, Adam's race shall help to heal it. Draw near, you other two."
The last words were spoken to Polly and the cabbie, who had now arrived. Polly, all eyes and mouth, was staring at Aslan and holding the cabbie's hand rather tightly. The cabbie gave one glance at the lion and took off his bowler hat. No one had yet seen him without it. When it was off, he looked younger and nicer, and more like a countryman, and less like a London cabman. Said Aslan to the cabby,
"I have known you long. Do you know me?"
"Well, no, sir," said the cabby. "Leastways, not in an ordinary manner of speaking. Yet I feel somehow, if I may make so free, as how we've met before."
"It is well," said the lion. "You know better than you think you know, and you shall live to know me better yet. How does this land please you?"
"It's a fair treat, sir," said the cabby.
"Would you like to live here always?"
"Well, you see, sir, I'm a married man," said the cabby. "If my wife was here, neither of us would ever want to go back to London, I reckon. We're both country folks, really."
Aslan threw up his shaggy head, opened his mouth and uttered a long single note, not very loud, but full of power. Polly's heart jumped in her body when she heard it. She felt sure that it was a call, and that anyone who heard that call would want to obey it, and, what's more, would be able to obey it, however many worlds and ages lay between. And so, though she was filled with wonder, she was not really astonished or shocked, when all of a sudden a young woman with a kind, honest face stepped out of nowhere and stood beside her. Polly knew at once that it was the cabbie's wife, fetched out of our world not by any tiresome magic rings, but quickly, simply, and sweetly as a bird flies to its nest. The young woman had apparently been in the middle of a washing day, for she wore an apron, her sleeves were rolled up to the elbow, and there were soap suds on her hands. If she had had time to put on her good clothes, her best hat had imitation cherries on it, she would have looked dreadful. As it was, she looked rather nice. Of course, she thought she was dreaming. That was why she didn't rush across to her husband and ask him what on earth had happened to them both. But when she looked at the lion, she didn't feel quite so sure it was a dream. Yet for some reason she did not appear to be very frightened. Then she dropped a little half-curtsy, as some country girls still knew how to do in those days. After that, she went and put her hand in the cabbie's, and stood there looking round her a little shyly.
"My children," said Aslan, fixing his eyes on both of them, "you are to be the first king and queen of Narnia."
The cabbie opened his mouth in astonishment, and his wife turned very red.
"You shall rule and name all these creatures, and do justice among them, and protect them from their enemies when enemies arise. And enemies will arise, for there is an evil witch in this world."
The cabbie swallowed hard two or three times and cleared his throat.
"Begging your pardon, sir," he said, "and thanking you very much, I'm sure which my missus does the same, but I ain't no sort of a chap for a job like that. I never had much education, you see." "Well," said Aslan, "can you use a spade and a plough and raise food out of the earth?"
"Yes, sir, I could do a bit of that sort of work, being brought up to it like."
"Can you rule these creatures kindly and fairly, remembering that they are not slaves, like the dumb beasts of the world you were born in, but talking beasts and free subjects?"
"I see that, sir," replied the cabbie. "I'd try to do the square thing by them all."
"And would you bring up your children and grandchildren to do the same?"
"It'd be up to me to try, sir. I'd do my best, wouldn't we, Nelly?"
"And you wouldn't have favourites either among your own children or among the other creatures, or let any hold another under, or use it hardly?" "I never could abide such goings on, sir.
and that's the truth. I'd give 'em what for if I caught 'em at it, said the cabby. All through this conversation his voice was growing slower and richer, more like the country voice he must have had as a boy, and less like the sharp, quick voice of a cockney. And if enemies came against the land, for enemies will arise, and there was war, would you be the first in the charge and the last in the retreat? Well, sir, said the cabby very slowly, a chap don't exactly know till he's been tried. I dare say I might turn out ever such a soft'un. Never did no fightin' except with my fists. I try, that is, I hope I'd try, to do my bit. Then, said Aslan, you will have done all that a king should do. Your coronation will be held presently, and you and your children and grandchildren shall be blessed, and some will be kings of Narnia, and others will be kings of Arkin Land, which lies yonder over the southern mountains. And you, little daughter, here he turned to Polly, are welcome. Have you forgiven the boy for the violence he did you in the Hall of Images, in the desolate palace of a cursed charn?
Yes, Aslan, we've made it up, said Polly.
That is well, said Aslan. And now for the boy himself.
Chapter 12 Strawberry's Adventure. Diggory kept his mouth very tight shut. He had been growing more and more uncomfortable. He hoped that whatever happened, he wouldn't blub or do anything ridiculous.
Son of Adam, said Aslan, are you ready to undo the wrong that you have done to my sweet country of Narnia on the very day of its birth?
Well, I don't see what I can do, said Diggory. You see, the queen ran away and—
I asked, are you ready, said the lion. Yes, said Diggory. He had had for a second some wild idea of saying, I'll try to help you if you'll promise to help about my mother. But he realized in time that the lion was not at all the sort of person one could try to make bargains with. But when he had said yes, he thought of his mother, and he thought of the great hopes he had had, and how they were all dying away, and a lump came in his throat, and tears in his eyes, and he blurted out,
But please, please, won't you, can't you give me something that will cure mother?
Up till then he had been looking at the lion's great front feet and the huge claws on them. Now, in his despair, he looked up at his face. What he saw surprised him as much as anything in his whole life. For the tawny face was bent down near his own, and wonder of wonders, great shining tears stood in the lion's eyes. They were such big, bright tears compared with Diggory's own, that for a moment he felt as if the lion must really be sorrier about his mother than he was himself.
My son, said Aslan, I know. Grief is great. Only you and I in this land know that yet. Let us be good to one another. But I have to think of hundreds of years in the life of Narnia. The witch whom you have brought into this world will come back to Narnia again, but it need not be yet. It is my wish to plant in Narnia a tree that she will not dare to approach, and that tree will protect Narnia from her for many years. So this land shall have a long, bright morning before any clouds come over the sun. You must get me the seed from which that tree is to grow.
Yes, sir, said Diggory. He didn't know how it was to be done, but he felt quite sure now that he would be able to do it. The lion drew a deep breath, stooped his head even lower, and gave him a lion's kiss. And at once Diggory felt that new strength and courage had gone into him.
Dear son, said Aslan, I will tell you what you must do. Turn and look to the west, and tell me what do you see.
"'I see terribly big mountains, Aslan,' said Diggory. "'I see this river coming down cliffs in a waterfall.'